righty then. That was, thank you very much for blessing us that way and lifting our spirits up. Let's take your Bibles, turn to John chapter 21, the end of John's Gospel. And we're going to be looking at verses 15 through 19 this morning. I came in downstairs this morning. Somebody said, "I didn't think you would be here." And I guess it's because, you know, the funeral yesterday. But it also might have been because in the bulletin it says that there's somebody else preaching today. On the inside, not in the order of worship. But Tricia Miller-Manarin is going to be here next week to preach. I'll be here, but Trish just happened to be in the area. She's the local leader of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship in the Mid-Atlantic area. And she says she's going to be in the Frederick area. And I said, "Well, come on. Let's get you in here and let everybody meet you and hear from you." So I'm going to be glad to hosting her next week. So y'all come, y'all hear her, and then you can say, "Well, I heard a good sermon this February." Right? All right, here we go. John chapter 21, starting at verse 15. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. And after this, he said to him, "Follow me." One day when Austin was young, now Austin's our second child, Angela's our first, and 4.5 years later came Austin. And so one day when he was young, he was with Pam, and as was often the case, he was exasperating her. Austin was always a lot of fun, still is, but he is often a handful also. And sometimes still is. And so on this particular day, Austin was self-aware enough to know that he was being a handful and that Pam was getting a little bit exasperated with him. And he said to her, he said, "You know, Mom, if you and Dad had had me first, there would be no Angela." And Pam said, "Well, you know, you're probably right, Austin." And the funny thing is Austin was actually kind of proud of that fact, you know. It's like the old archetypal story that underlines the Cain and Abel story, the younger sibling plotting the demise of the older sibling. And, you know, Austin knew murder was off the table, but he was imagining other scenarios by which he could pull the same thing off and avoid the curse of Cain at the same time and stuff. But, you know, it's true that you never really know what's in front of you when you make a decision. Any decision. When you make the decision to become a parent, you don't really know what you're getting into, especially the first time. When Angela was little, if she touched something she wasn't supposed to touch, I would sometimes, and we told her about it, right? She knew about it, and she still did it and stuff. So I would grab her hand, and I'd hold her hand in mine, and I'd slap my hand, just like that. And she would cry like I had touched her inner soul and wounded her, you know. And of course, she didn't feel any pain at all. It was just her nature. She was a sensitive child, and as chill a child as you can imagine. And like I said, that was just her nature. Though Pam and I thought it was our nurture. You know, we were great parents, and so we had this thing down, and it was on our first try, and what's wrong with everybody else, you know? So a few years later, us being as good as we were at it, we thought, well, let's have another one. And hopefully this time it'll be a boy, you know, to kind of keep balance in the universe and everything. And then I'd have, you know, somebody I could watch a ball game with or something like that. So Austin came. And it was pretty evident early on that this was a different creature altogether than what we had had before. When Angela was little, I put her in the high chair, and I'd put some Cheerios on her tray, and she would take the Cheerios one by one and gently place them in her mouth and eat it, and then take another one and daintily pick that Cheerio up and put it on there. With Austin, I'd put Cheerios on his tray, and he'd grab them with a big, you know, fistful, and he'd throw them, you know, towards his face, and some of them would get on his mouth, and some of them would land on the floor in the other room. You know, it was just a completely different thing. So one day, Austin touched something that he wasn't supposed to touch, that we had told him not to touch, you know, a electrical outlet or something, you know. So I did what worked, right? I grabbed his hand and I went, you know, I gave it a good slap. And Austin looked at me, and on the inside he said, "Oh my goodness, I have an idiot for a father," you know. So then I took his hand, you know, and I slapped his hand this time. Nothing. And he touched the outlet again. And I took his hand, gave it another slap. He touched the outlet again. I took his hand, slapped it even harder. It's turning pink by now, all right? Y'all, somebody's going to arrest me. I'm sorry, but... But then Austin looks at me, touches the outlet, and then puts his hand in front of me. And I looked at Pam and I said, "I'm going to need a gun." You know, that was, I'm going to need a gun. But that's how it is when you decide to become a parent. You don't know what you're getting into until you're there. And in fact, in life's most important things, you really don't know where you're going until you're on the way. You've plunged in. Or as the 13th century theologian Rumi once says more poetically, as you start to walk on the way appears. As you start to walk on the way appears. You may know a great deal about child development and family dynamics and effective parenting techniques and stuff, but parenting isn't a test that you pass or fail. It's not a set of skills that you master. Parenting, in the end, is love. It is love in all circumstances, regardless of the child. It's a commitment to a bond with another person, and a unique person who's not like their older brother or sister. A person who's going to make their own choices and take risks and suffer disappointments and endure heartbreak and face danger, and life with them as you raise them and as you love them will life will bang them up and bruise them, and for each bang and bruise they get, you get the same bang and the same bruise. You can't control what happens to them. And you don't see a lot of it coming. Love takes you places that you can't see. Takes you places you can't foresee. And the same can be said about faith, because at its core, faith rests upon love. Faith is about going wherever your beloved goes. And that's one of the lessons that we learn as we look at the disciples. You go to the call of the disciples. Jesus is walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, and he sees Peter and Andrew casting their nets. They're fishing, and he invites them to follow. "Hey, come with me. I'll make you fishers of people." And they drop their nets and they immediately go. Next he calls out to James and John. They're mending their nets and they're in their father's boat. They're in the family business. And they jump out of the boat and they scramble after him. And when you look at these accounts, there's nowhere where Jesus issues a command to these guys. Their response isn't an act of obedience to an authority figure. Instead, they're drawn to Jesus. There's just something about this guy, and you shouldn't think that these guys are making these huge lifestyle changes for a complete stranger. They already knew Jesus. They probably went to the same synagogue as he did. They were from the same general area, and they knew all along that there was something different about this guy. And I don't mean that, you know, Jesus walked around with a halo over his head, or that they sensed in some way that he was God incarnate. No, just they had the sense, you know, like we all do. You know, when we grow up, there's always a few kids that you sense are different than everybody else. They stand out. The kid in class who not only knows the right answers, but knows why the right answers are the right answers. They just understand, you know, math or whatever at a deeper level than anybody else. You just know. We're seeing LeBron James play basketball in middle school, you know, and know he was better than the most high schoolers that you knew. Everybody knew. And so that's what I mean. They've known all along that Jesus was just one of those guys. You know, I mean, 12-year-olds debate religious scholars in the temple, you know. He's that guy. And there might have been whispers all around as Jesus grew into adulthood that maybe this guy might not just be special, but that he might be the one, the Messiah. Not Messiah like we think of Messiah, the guy who dies on the cross to forgive us of our sins, but the Messiah as they thought of the Messiah, the guy who would finally restore the kingdom of God, which to them meant the kingdom of Israel, restore Israel to its former glory as in the days of David and Solomon when the kingdom stretched from sea to shining sea, or supposedly according to lore from the land of their ancient enemies, the Egyptians, to the land of the more recent enemies, Babylon and Syria. That this would be the guy. This would be the guy to get rid of the new Babylonians, the Romans, and any other foreigners defiling the land. Jesus would be, he'd be kind of like Judas Maccabeus, that guy, a great guerrilla leader of the previous century who went around gathering a band of merry men to terrorize the conquering Gentiles. And this Judas Maccabeus, he died heroically fighting against the Syrians, and the movement that he started led briefly to a period of independence, the only independence that Israel had known for over 500 years. So maybe Jesus is now, he's going to gather his band of merry men. So sure, they'll sign up. They don't really quite know what it is that they're signing up for. They don't really realize who Jesus is or what Jesus is. They don't realize it yet, but Jesus is not just God incarnate. He is love incarnate. And love takes you places that you can't foresee. Love has a way of creating love, of engendering love, of awakening something in a person and nurturing it from a seed to a seedling and finally into a great tree that gives life to others. So over the course of time, as these disciples follow Jesus around, they begin to love him. Even though he says things that sound strange coming from the lips of a revolutionary leader, you know, like love your enemies and pray for your persecutors. You don't get that part, but whatever, they trust him. They trust him. Which is the beginning of faith, right? They love him because He loves them. And they trust Him because He loves them. And because they love Him. You hear that? They trust Him because He loves them. We frequently equate faith with belief and with trust, and rightfully so. The Greek word underlying it involves those elements, as well as the element of faithfulness, of actual fellowship. And Christians, we do believe things about Jesus, things that are important, and we believe about things about, you know, what God is doing through Him and has done through Him, and what God is doing in the life of the world and in our own personal lives. And throughout history, the church has expressed those beliefs in different ways, statements about God and statements about Jesus. Some churches every Sunday recite one of the historic Christian creeds, the data points about Jesus. Others sign confessional statements. We have beliefs. But no one ever wrote a song about they will know we are Christians by our beliefs. No one ever wrote that song. They will know we are Christians by our love. They will know we are Christians by our love and by the love of Christ working in us and working through us. And when they see that love, when they experience that love from you, that will cause people to trust you. They have to trust you first before they can love you. And so people can trust you when you talk to them about why you love the way you love. Why we love the way we love, fully and unconditionally and sacrificially, because that's what we do, right? We're working on it. We're working on it. And then, once they come to know that they are loved by us and that they can trust us because we love them, then it's not that big a step for them to trust the one who first loved us and first loved them and gave His life for them. See, it's not our beliefs that engender faith in others, it's our love. And on that day that Peter and then, you know, along with Andrew and James and John, they started tramping along with Jesus. They never imagined where all of this was going to end up. And Peter never imagined where his love for Jesus would take him. And even though Jesus tried to tell them numerous times, at least three separate times that are recorded in the Gospels, that the cross lay in his future, and if it lay in his future, then it lay in their futures if they would follow him all the way, if they were obedient enough to actually deny themselves and pick up a cross and follow him. If. But they weren't. Peter, even though he defiantly proclaimed at the Passover table, you know, where Jesus took the bread of the Passover and he broke it and said, This is my body. It's broken. My body is broken like this bread, and it's broken for you. And in that moment, you know, Peter proclaimed that he would never forsake, though all others might forsake Jesus, Peter never would. And he ate that broken bread, not realizing that he wasn't going to fulfill the promise that he was making when he ate it. So here we are at the end of John's Gospel. And this is after the resurrection. This is after the empty tomb, that new life emerging from and forever transcending the very depths of sorrow and suffering and death, which Peter didn't see coming either. And they've just finished having breakfast. The breakfast that Jesus had prepared himself. So, if you will, it's kind of a Lord's breakfast. It really is. It's echoing the Lord's Supper. First broken bread and then broken fish. It's an echo. Of course, the broken bread and the broken fish hearkens to the feeding of the 5,000. When the disciples said, there's all of them, And there's only 12 of us. No way we can feed them. And then Jesus showed them what could happen with the faith of a little boy with some bread and some fish. And so he gives them this breakfast, and the breakfast also reminds them of his calling, that while they were fishers, Jesus said, I'm going to make you fishers of people. All of this going on in a little simple breakfast. So then after this Lord's breakfast, Jesus says to Peter, Peter, do you love me? First, Peter, do you love me more than these? Because that's what Peter was saying at the Lord's Supper. Though all else forsake you, I never will. So now Jesus is asking me, so Peter, knowing what you know now, you love me more than these. And Peter's response is telling. He doesn't say, yeah, I love you more than these. He just says, Lord, you know I love you. Peter's grown up a little bit. Resurrection will do that to you. So he says, yes, Lord, I love you. Jesus asks again, Lord, you know I love you. And Jesus asks a third time. And harkens back not only to the Lord's Supper, but to Peter's thrice denial later on in the courtyard. And this time, Jesus takes the metaphor, and instead of fishing, he changes it. He tells Peter, well, if you love me, then feed my sheep. And his sheep are not just Christians. You know, he's not just telling them to go feed the church. He says his sheep are the whole world, all the people in it, you know. Feed them, Peter. Feed them. And then he tells Peter, you know, Peter, when you were young, and read, immature and impetuous. When you were young, you were in charge of yourself and everything around you. You made the decisions about your life. But now that you're older, read, now that you've reached maturity. It's just been 3 years, so he's not just talking about age. Talking about the maturity of love and the maturity of faith. So now that you've reached maturity, you're going to be going in a direction so that at a certain point, it's probably going to come sooner than you think it's going to be. This love that you profess to me is going to take you places you didn't intend, you didn't ask for, you don't want. But love is going to compel you. Love is going to compel you, and that's going to require a faith that you didn't have not too long ago. Now, Peter, he says, you're ready. Feed my sheep. Follow me. Jesus, God incarnate, love incarnate, takes you to places you can't foresee. Does things in you that you didn't anticipate. Compassion replacing judgment. Cooperation replacing competition. Feeling the world's loneliness and suffering and poverty in your own heart and soul and gut. Learning to be free from resentments and grudges and fear. Having eyes wide open to how this world really is, but not letting fear and worry rent any space in your head. In other words, faith is the way of love. If you want greater faith, love more. Love deeper. Love better. Love more widely. Love people you wouldn't have loved before. Love people who don't deserve your love. Love people who are unlovable. If you want greater faith, love more. Love better. Faith is the way of love. And the way appears only once you've started walking on the way. The beginning of the journey is not the journey. It's just the beginning. Walk the journey. and let faith guide you, and love characterize you. I was looking at our invitation hymn before I got up to preach, and listen to the words of this. I'm not sure if I'm familiar with this hymn, to be honest with you. Maybe when we hum a few bars, I'll recognize it or something. But listen to the words. Oh, Jesus, I have promised to serve Thee to the end. Be Thou forever near me, my Master and my friend. I shall not fear the battle if Thou art by my side, nor wander from the path if Thou wilt be my guide. Lord, I don't know what days are ahead of me, but I promised to serve Thee to the end. Is that your promise? Is that your commitment? The beginning of the walk is not the walk, but you can't take the walk unless you begin and take that first step. And we invite you to take that first step today. Number 276 is our hymn of invitation. Let's stand and let's sing together. And if you're ready to make that walk and make that journey, or to continue that walk, continue that journey, you come and share that with me right now.